Towers and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 60, The Best Years of Our Lives. We're going to be talking about this 1946 film by William Wyler, starring a whole bunch of big deal actors. But before we can do that, I must introduce you to our wonderful panel of guests here to talk about it with me, beginning with Erica Ensign. Hello and welcome back.
Hello. It is good to be here. I would like to order a chocolate sundae, please. Two cherries.
I'm glad you specified the fruit part. Yes. Next up, Randy Dutinga. Hello.
Well, you know what I always say, Shelley? If Teresa is right, you can't go wrong.
If that isn't on the poster, it should be.
Should.
And joining us is Mickey Maynard. Hello.
Hello. And I wish my uncle played the piano in a bar.
Mm, I know, right?
Yeah.
I'd just like to have an Uncle Butch. That just seems fun. Like, yeah. My uncles had names like Hugo and Gunther, so.
I mean, that's pretty cool, too.
I guess so. They were lovely men, but, you know, no Butch. Anyways, thanks for joining me to talk about The Best Years of Our Lives. As I warned the panel ahead of time, this is an almost three-hour movie. We will not be spending 3 hours discussing it, but there is a lot to talk about. 1946, William Wyler, who had just returned from the war himself as a veteran, we'll talk about that in due course, made this film for Samuel Goldwyn with Frederick March, Myrna Loy, Dana Andrews, Teresa Wright, Harold Russell, and a bunch of other actors that I will talk about because there are some small parts in this movie played by people that I really enjoy. So both an all-star cast and a movie that was recognized a lot at the Oscars. It was the first movie to win 8 Oscars. It's second only to Gone with the Wind in that category. It was also a huge financial success. So it was a pretty big, important movie right at the end of the war. And I will start out with my usual first question to each of you. And what's your experience with this movie, Erica? I'll start with you.
You know what? I knew you were going to ask me this. So after I finished watching the movie, I tried to think back, when was the first time I saw this movie? And I realized I just feel like it's been with me for most of my life. I could not pinpoint the first time that I watched it. I suspect it was probably when I was in college. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and my degree is in communication arts. So it was basically the sort of film school side of things. And I watched a lot of old movies for school, and I'm assuming this was one of them, but it's also possible that I just discovered on like American Movie Classics or something at the time. And so I just know that whenever it was that I watched this movie for the first time, I completely fell in love with it. I did not realize that it was 2 hours and 52 minutes long because it just didn't feel that way. I think, you know, we'll probably talk about the length of it, but I think the fact that you've got sort of three main characters who the story is focusing around, it's kind of like each one of them gets less than an hour for their, you know, official story, even though they weave together. So for me, it just like, I think I went into it not knowing how long it was. And when I came out, I was like, oh, wow, a lot of time has passed. I didn't know that was going to happen. And I liked it so much that I have just come back to revisit it time and time again. So, I mean, I guess a considerable amount of my life has been spent watching this movie, considering how long it is and how many times I have seen it. But I tend to spread out my viewings of it long enough that I have a terrible memory. So I sort of forget I remember the beats, but I don't remember the specifics. So every single time I watch it, I get the excitement of being like, okay, well, it's very clear that Dana Andrews and Teresa Wright are going to get together because who can resist Dana Andrews? But I don't remember how, I don't remember when. And this time watching it, you know, the world is, as we record, the world is in turmoil. Surprise, surprise. And I think I started crying at the beginning of the movie this time instead of at the end. This movie, it seems like every time I watch it, a different part of it sort of gets me in the feels. And this time, I think it was the beginning where Frederick March comes back and Myrna Loy, like, she's like, kids, who's at the door? And as soon as she's like, oh, they're not answering me, it's got to be him. And she turns around and I was just like in tears. And my spouse was sitting next to me just before leaving the house. And I was like, it's going to be a long night. And he just shook his head. So, yeah.
That got to me too. Well, are we ever going to get him interested in old movies? That's another story for another time.
He appreciated the direction. The bits that he saw afterwards, he was like, oh, I really appreciated that shot and the way this was framed. And I was like, oh, you should have stayed for the rest of it. There's so many more good shots.
Oh, there's so much cinematography to talk about. But in short, Erica, you spent the best years of your life watching the best
watching of one of the best movies of my life.
There you go. Randy, how about you? Have you seen this before?
This is actually my first time seeing this movie. I've always been aware of it, but it just seemed like it would last as long as the war. and for some reason, I thought it would be too heartwarming for me, and I wouldn't deal with that. But turns out it's such a discovery. It's one of those times when you watch a movie that you've heard about and it's just fantastic. And I just feel like it's I think of it as a tender movie and like all the meanings of tender, like it's warm, like a tender person, but it's also fragile and vulnerable. And then it also has this undertone of we may all be blown up by a nuclear war tomorrow. There's just so much going on and a lot of good performances. And of course, you know, the music and the cinematography and just thinking about, the music is kind of, when they show the little town, it's very Aaron Copland, very Americana, but mm-hmm. there's this kind of dark underside that they're being very, open about in a lot of ways. So it just seems very, very ahead of its time and kind of timeless.
Mickey, do you have a backstory to Busters of Life history?
So this is on my top 10 list of my favorite movies. And I think at some point, you know, if we're looking for a topic of a show, maybe you could get us all on to read off our lists and we could compare notes.
The Incomparable, we call that a draft. We will do that soon. We haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a Christmas episode or something. When I was a kid growing up in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, this was right before cable, and we had, you know, a big antenna on top of the roof, and you could pull in Canadian television. We could pull in Cleveland, Toledo, and then stations from Canada. So TV Ontario was on channel 32 from Leamington, Ontario, which is a little bit east of Windsor. And on Saturday nights, they had a show called Saturday Night at the Movies starring Elwe Yost. And Elwe Yost, if anyone's Canadian listening to this, they will know who he is. We in Detroit had Bill Kennedy, who was kind of a C actor, but he had a movie show for many years. And Elwe Yost would show movies, and in the middle of the movies, he would do interviews. And so because he was based in Toronto, people would come to Toronto from Hollywood and he would interview them there. And then they got the funding to send Elwe to Los Angeles, and Elwe would go out to LA and basically interview Canadian actors. But he showed The Best Years of Our Lives. And I was probably in high school. My parents were gone. I was like trying to dial in channel 32. And I just remember watching it and collapsing into tears the first time I watched it. And then pretty much I cry every time I see it. And one reason is that the Dana Andrews character, who clearly flew in World War II, my father also flew in World War II. He was a navigator and he flew all those missions with the Royal Air Force from Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, and they invaded Sicily and then they went up Italy and all that. And so he came back and had to restart his life in America. And when I see Dana Andrews at the airline graveyard, I just think of my dad coming back from World War II, not knowing what he was going to do, you know, and that just really resonates with me. And luckily for my dad, American Airlines offered jobs to men who had been in the Army Air Corps, you know, if they came in and interviewed, and they interviewed my dad and they made him director of operations in Detroit, which is how we ended up growing up in Detroit. So it really has a personal connection for me.
The thing about this movie, and Erica was talking about maybe having seen it in college and film school or film classes or something, that's not some experience I ever had, even though I haunted classic movie repertory theaters and like Mickey in high school, instead of getting into trouble, I was trying to dial in movie channels because we were in the broadcast days. Right. And so we were lucky the Channel 24 in Austin had afternoon Saturday movies. But I remember this much more as a popular movie, a TV movie, than a movie that was studied in my limited film school type experience, which is surprising to me because it's such a well-made movie and it has so much to say about cinematography. And I think the length probably has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I think also that on the surface, it is a very sweet, gentle, tender movie, but it has a lot to say. And I think there are, and I've read some reviews that sort of that get it, and I admire not only the craft of it, but the storytelling and what it's trying to say. But I think there are reviewers out there who just sort of see it as overly sentimental and are looking for sort of a tougher indictment of the way men were treated when they came back from war and that sort of thing. And that's sort of an interesting dichotomy, which is, I think, the only thing that keeps this movie off a lot of people's radar is just that it's has this sort of tender side to it.
Well, it's a post-war movie that's not about war, so you can't really classify it as a war movie, which keeps it probably off of some curriculum. It's really a very interesting study of PTSD, which you don't see in a lot of late 1940s movies. There's not any discussion of race in it, and I guess that's no surprise, given that, you know, it's all white people in the movie. And I think that could have given it a little bit different aspect than we got in the movie, you know, but that doesn't put it into any of the Black movie studies categories. So it sort of falls through the cracks a little bit. But the interesting thing is, I think it's even more resonant today than it might have been when it came out, because there's just nothing about what the trauma that these men went through, and women too, after World War II. They all came back. They were expected to get jobs. They were expected to get married and have their kids. They're expected to get brand new houses. They're expected to have their two cars and their swimming pools and their vacations and all that. And nobody talked about what they had experienced and seen over in Europe. And, you know, that had not been talked about for years and years and years. And we got to the Vietnam era and people then kind of gradually started talking about it, but it was 25 years later. And I sort of feel like that's a reason why we didn't get this movie in our film classes, is it just didn't fit in any category.
Yeah, I think it bridges a lot of things, because, you know, it's in a way it's just like a sort of day in the life kind of movie where it's showing you a snapshot of middle America, you know, the unspecified Boone City America. Unless tell me if I'm wrong. Is there really a Boone City somewhere, or is that
there is not. Okay, it's modeled on Cincinnati. And in fact, some of the aerial shots at the beginning are of a football stadium in Cincinnati and a high school in Cincinnati. And I had trouble, too, because I remembered that it is a big enough city that there are multiple nightclubs and a great big drugstore. Mm-hmm. And so it's not tiny small town America. And for some reason, and they talked about Cleveland, so clearly it wasn't Cleveland. And then I read Cincinnati. It was like, oh, that makes sense. That's a big city. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wondered about that because, yeah, it does sort of like give you this general, here's Boone City, and you could take a flight east or you could take a flight west, which means it's somewhere in the middle. But in addition to being sort of just that snapshot of like, this is the world right now, there's a little bit of social commentary, you know, it's also a romance. And it's also a romance in the older couple sort of learning to live with each other and love each other again. And it is also a little bit of a film dealing with the trauma of, you know, PTSD and physical injuries and soldiers coming back from war. So it's little bits of all of these things, which does make it a little bit harder to pigeonhole. And actually, as I was watching it, Shelley, I remembered a previous episode of Lions, Towers and Shields that you and I did about I'll Be Seeing You, the Christmas film starring Joseph Cotten. And I remember during that episode, I said I just didn't quite buy Joseph Cotten's performance as a sort of damaged soldier, and it just didn't quite ring true for me. And I found myself throughout the entire thing wishing it was Dana Andrews. And I would like to present this film as Exhibit A as to why, because I really was just taken, like his performance, especially the moment coming back to once again the airfield scene when he's walking through, and then specifically when he's sitting in the you know bomb sites area of that jet. And just there are tons of parts of this movie where characters are conveying everything with looks and motion and blocking And there's no dialogue. And I think that's one of my favorite things about this film is just how well directed and acted and written it is. All three of those things work together very well. But I just thought Dana Andrews knocked it out of the park in terms of conveying what felt believable and heart-wrenching to me as a soldier who was trying to sort of shake his demons, so to speak. And yeah, so like, not that I think that Joseph Cotten, you know, wasn't the right character or actor for the rest of that film, but those scenes just didn't work for me in that one, whereas they really, really do in this.
And I don't exactly agree with you about that, but I see how the performances are very different.
Yeah.
And Dana Andrews enacts PTSD not as something that overtakes his life. It's something that affects him in moments. Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. I think that totally makes sense for that character and the guy he is. He comes off and whatever ambivalent relationship he has with his own heroism, he comes back as a pretty confident, pretty high-powered guy. He was an officer in the army, and he was, you know, had respect and had all those medals and things. And obviously those aren't what give him self-worth, but he comes back to an environment where he doesn't have the quote-unquote value that he did in the military, and he has personal problems that he has to deal with. But the PTSD is, again, just another aspect of his personality that comes up a couple of times. The first night he's home when he's, sleeping off a drunk, and then later in that beautiful airfield scene, which, by the way, talking about filming locations and stuff, that was done at the Ontario Airport in California, not Ontario, Canada, but Ontario in California, which is east of Los Angeles, and where those junk planes were in fact stored before they were going to be recycled or thrown out or whatever happened to them.
Wow.
So let's the structure of Best Years of Our Life, which I guess we've sort of alluded to, is that you have three soldiers coming back from different war experiences. So I guess one way to sort of structure the conversation is to start with each of those men and their families. We have Frederick March, who is married to, he plays Al. He's married to Myrna Loy. He was an infantry sergeant, but he comes home as a banker. He lives in a fancy apartment. And so it's funny because there's not, as Mickey said, there's no discussion of race, which I noticed and was aware of. And class is kind of weirdly handled because there are plenty of class signifiers. And obviously the man who was most well off when he left was Al, Frederick March's character. And he and Merle Loy live in a nice apartment and they're a banker. And almost immediately when he comes home, he gets a promotion at the bank, whereas the other two guys either have different job experiences that we'll get to. But in the Army, he had a not particularly glamorous or high status job. He was an infantry sergeant, which has a lot of stripes. He has I think he's a 5-stripe sergeant, which means he was fairly high up as an enlisted man. But he wasn't, you know, an officer eating bonbons or even commanding large numbers of troops. So it's kind of interesting. And he comes home with a drinking problem and with sort of an uneasy idea about what he wants to do. I don't think he wants to go back to his job at the bank as quickly as the opportunity is presented to him. He has an adult kid and a kid who's in high school. The adult is Teresa Wright, who will, as we will find out, become involved with Dana Andrews. And a little bit of a Myrna Loy trivia for you, because she plays his wife, Millie. The reason she's top billed is because she's Myrna Loy, and she got that top billing in exchange for taking a smaller part. They're like, please come and do the movie. She's like, you know, I'm usually the star of these things. I'm like, well, okay, we'll give you top billing if you'll come over and do it. And I think she's perfect for the part.
Yep.
So do we think Teresa Wright is the female star in this movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that I think the women's parts are not as quite as evenly spread as the men's, but I do think that like hers are only slightly bigger than, for example, Myrna Loy. Definitely Virginia Mayo comes in third.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then there's also Kathy O'Donnell, who I forget every time. Sorry, Kathy. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing about, and I just quickly, even though it's in the wrong spot, I'll quickly insert my love of Kathy O'Donnell, not particularly in this movie, but she makes movies a couple of years later that I really enjoy, where she's sort of I'll draw some threads a little bit later. But Kathy O'Donnell is one of those people that you're sort of seeing early in her career. Steve Cochran is in here too. And you're just like, oh, look, they're going to be bigger stars later. And that's kind of not, even though Kathy O'Donnell got leads in a couple of film noirs, she was never a huge star. But yeah, she has a considerably smaller part.
So the only clunky performance, I think, in this movie is Rob, who is played by Michael Hall. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that Rob really only shows up in one or two scenes at the beginning and kind of disappears.
And there's supposed to be a reason for that. From what I read, he his contract ended partway through filming. Oh, and the Goldwyn didn't want to keep him on and keep on his contract. So he's around for maybe the first third of the movie, and you never see him again. And this is interesting because it suggests to me that it was filmed, the movie was filmed in sequence, and that might explain why the actor Russell that plays the soldier with the hook arms, how he feels to me like his performance improves during the movie.
Yeah.
So that made me think that, you know, that all tied it together. And the only other thing about Michael Hall is he seems to have been the cast member who survived the longest. He actually died a couple years ago in 2020 at the age of 93, survived by his husband.
Randy, always bringing the deep IMDb dives. I appreciate
love it.
That.
Always like, yeah, who's dead? Well, it's always fascinating to me, you know. It's always fascinating to look at these movies from the 40s, the last few that we've looked at on the show, and see that people that played kids or young people, in some cases, are still alive or just passed away. It's just, and also thinking about, I was thinking about how the characters in this movie, the younger ones, they're just as old as my grandparents were. So it just makes me think about how close we are to the people in this movie, and then to the characters that they're playing. They're close to us in history.
I heard randomly on the radio yesterday, I heard a song by Death Cab for Cutie, and it had a line in it, something about saying that I find it hard to watch movies from the 1950s because all the people in these movies are dead. And I got angry at the radio because I was like, no, first of all, the 50s? Okay, maybe if you're watching movies from the 20s or 30s, you'd find one that's got like everybody's dead. But I was like, I bristled at a random song lyric because I watched so many old movies and I was like, they are not all dead.
Oh, I couldn't even process that kind of anger. So the interesting thing about the Rob character is that they kind of were starting to give him a story of conflict with his father, because the Frederick March character comes home and he has war souvenirs, and he says a few unfortunate things about he's brought home a samurai sword, and he seems to have some pride about the killing he's done. And his son is basically disinterested. And some of that seems to be potentially politically motivated, and some of it is just, I don't know how to deal with this, Dad. It's not what I was expecting to happen when I came home from school today. And that's never followed up, because of course we never see him again, and the story becomes about his big sister, Teresa Wright, who is already on her way to becoming a domestic goddess. She's just in the kitchen helping mom the whole entire time, even before she meets Dana Andrews and puts him to bed after he's drunk. So it's interesting because they all seem to live together. She's, you know, 25-ish. And of course I did my usual, because it always matters to me whether the ages of the actors and the ages of the romantic partners are appropriate. And I have deemed that Teresa Wright and Dana Andrews are a perfectly appropriately aged
Yay!
Couple.
That
as are, because
happy.
I'm judgmental like that. Mm-hmm. As are, by the way, Dana Andrews and Virginia Mayo, who doesn't end up with, she's like 2 years younger than Teresa Wright. So anyway, that's my weird IMDb penchant.
How are Frederick March and Myrna Loy?
Oh, I didn't look that up. I think he's a little younger than she is. One moment. Talk amongst
Even
yourselves.
Even better.
No, I looked at Myrna Loy and Teresa Wright, and Myrna Loy was only 15 years older than she was.
Well, that's true. That's a fair point.
She would have had to have been like a, you know, a high school.
Well, of course, you know, the characters they're playing are not necessarily the same ages as the actors playing them.
No, but that's the only guidepost you have, you know.
But Myrna Loy was a star. Was she a star during Silence? Did she do
She wasn't. Play? She wasn't really a star. She acts. Well, the interesting thing is she, and the reason her name is Myrna Loy, because that is not her name. Mm-hmm. I can't remember her name, but she is from Montana, and she's a very much sort of quote unquote all American white girl. Yeah. She played exotic Asian types in right. the '20s, and they yeah. changed her. They did makeup to make her look more exotic than she was, and that was the kind of part she was playing up until the early 30s. In fact, there are a couple of crazy precodes I could show you with Myrna Loy sort of doing Asian drag. Ugh, and wow. then right about the time she goes to MGM and starts doing Thin Man with William Powell, she sort of begins this sort of all-American. She's not a mom figure in the Thin Man movies exactly, but she's a comedian and she's just sort of a pal to all the guys. And, you know, that her trajectory completely changes once she gets to MGM in the early 30s.
Yeah, so Teresa Wright's first movies were late 30s, correct?
Like early 40s, I think. Let's see. So the answer to the Myrna Loy is 10 years younger than Frederick March, and she's as you say 15 years younger than Teresa Wright, older than Teresa Wright. So yeah.
Which also, you mentioned Silence. It's interesting that a couple of Mrs. Parrish, the mother of Homer was a silent film actress, and so was Hortense with fantastic.
Oh, we'll talk about Gladys George, who I adore.
Yeah. So there's some throwbacks to the silent era kind of lurking in the background of the movie.
Yeah, so I'm finding Teresa Wright did a lot of TV that I don't remember because IMDb is sorting things by movie and by television. Mm-hmm. She famously, of course, was in Shadow of a Doubt with Joseph Cotten, Alfred Hitchcock movie, fairly early in her career. I actually saw Teresa Wright in a Broadway play in 1980.
Whoa.
Mornings at 7. It was very cool. It was Teresa Wright, Marina Sullivan, Nancy Marchand, and I forget who the fourth was, but it's these four women. It was amazing. I dragged my friends were all like young kids going to our first theater, and they all wanted to go to musicals, which we did, and we loved it. And then I said, we have to go see Mornings at 7 with all these old actresses. And they were like, what are you talking about?
I'm so glad you got to see that.
Wow. It was so awesome. Yeah. So we have this family of you know, Al is, as I say, he very quickly, I mean, he's the one the first night home that basically says, let's go out because I'm really physically uncomfortable. And he goes out and proceeds to get plastered, which you sort of think, oh, well, that's understandable. He's back from the war. And that's kind of his first night thing. But that becomes a lot of his storyline. He drinks to excess. He seems uncomfortable in his own skin. He almost immediately gets this job back at the bank, which is sort of ambivalent about. And then he is told he's going to be making loans to GIs, but then he gets pushed back when he makes loans based on sort of his understanding of what they are as people as opposed to collateral, which is sort of understandable, I guess, or, you know, that would be the conflict.
You know, I feel like I am kind of glad that poor Rob didn't make the cut in terms of keeping his contract and building that out, because I mean, honestly, had he been there and if we had had more sort of back and forth and pushback between him and his dad about, you know, I'm an ex-soldier, I killed a lot of people, I am a young, bright student, and I am interested in the geopolitical landscape of the entire world and learning about facts and blah, blah, blah. Like, that might have pushed the movie more into fitting into more school curricula, and maybe it would be a more well-known film, as we were talking about earlier. But for me, it flows really well as sort of a... It's not fully a romance, but the romance is one of the through lines that you can point to, or three of the through lines, I guess, that you can point to for the film. And to me, those are sort of like the tent poles that the rest of everything else hangs on. And I feel like adding even more scenes between Rob and Al would have pulled a little too heavily, I think, at those tent poles and slowed the movie down. And as I think I said before, to me, it doesn't feel like a 2-hour and 52-minute movie. I love every moment so much that it is just constantly pulling me along and I'm really interested. It's like reading a book, and it's like a scene ends, it's like a chapter ends, and it's like, I can't go to bed yet. I need to find out what happens next. So on to the next character. Yay, you've taken me back to see, you know, what nonsense is Virginia Mayo getting up to her in her shiny robes and stuff. And I think adding more scenes that are more overtly grappling with the societal issues of the time would have maybe slowed it down and made it a little bit more awkward for me, somebody who gets anxious about that particular type of more overt conflict on screen. Whereas, like, the way that it's sprinkled in this movie, I think for me and my sort of level of general anxiety was perfect, because every once in a while you have a scene where Dana Andrews is punching somebody out, you know, through a counter and falling down. Or you have the early scene that we already talked about with Rob and the guns and you know, here's a flag that I took off of a dead man. You should be excited about this. And he instantly, you know, Rob pivots to, oh, this, you know, this is a fact about the Japanese culture and their love of family. All of the scenes about Homer and him being, you know, his family treating him differently simply because he's disabled. All of those things are so important and such an important part of why I love this movie. But I think the way that they are craftily threaded throughout the film in between other things that are tugging on your heartstrings for different reasons, I think really works for me. And poor Rob, I think I never noticed until you guys just told me. I never noticed that he disappeared and that they never followed up on that. And I think it's because I didn't care so much for his performance and I didn't care as much about that particular part of the storyline that that I was kind of okay with it disappearing. And now I'm never going to unsee that, but that's okay.
Well, if it helps, he didn't go out with them because, you know, he's in high school and they're old enough to drink and he's not.
Exactly.
So that was the explanation for me for that first scene. Like, why did they go out and not even tell Rob they were going? It's because, well, he's in high school.
And he has school in the morning, you know?
Right. But the other thing is, I think I noticed this and I thought about, well, if they tried to remake it even 10 years later, but certainly further forward than that, I think there would have been a lot more politics in it. And there's only the two instances of where we come close to politics, which is Rob and Al having this conflict, and then later in the drugstore when Dana Andrews ends up punching that guy out. And those are valid things, and I'm glad they're in the movie. But I do think that any sort of societal discussion that went beyond the lives of those individual characters, in other words, fear, that's my definition of politics in this context, if where we're talking about how and why things happened politically that don't have to do with these characters, I think any of that would have diverted our story, because this is absolutely a story about three individuals and their families. And I agree with you, Eric. I think the way that the character stories are threaded together is extremely well done. It's one of the directorial and editing triumphs of the movie, and something that could easily be broken, because I've seen a lot of movies that are divided into threes that aren't put together quite this well. And yeah, if you, I think Wyler made a very conscious choice to stay within these characters' lives, and you don't feel like, well, why aren't we talking about post-war politics? Why aren't we talking more about the rise of anti-communism? Since Dana Andrews played a guy on radio called I Was a Communist for the FBI, but that's a whole other thing. sorry, random radio trivia. Just had to throw that in there. I think it was the right amount, and I enjoy it for that reason. I do sort of want to pivot to the other two stories too, but anything else we want to say about the Frederick March family to the Stevenson, that's their name, before we sort of talk a little bit about Dana Andrews and Virginia Mayo?
There was one interesting thing about Peggy's character. So she works at a hospital, right? Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I think she's a nurse.
She's a nurse, and she rescues Dana Andrews from his PTSD nightmare episode. And she knew exactly what to do. And he, you know, they're at breakfast the next morning, and he's, you know, kind of like, did I get out of line? And she said, no, you didn't. And, you know, she says, I work in a hospital, I've seen everything, or words to that effect. And I was thinking about World War II, and a lot of women didn't work in hospitals. They worked in plants, in manufacturing plants, and making armaments. My mother did that, things like that for the war. And she ended up in a hospital. And I kind of wonder if it might have been in a rehab hospital or somewhere where the servicemen came, the wounded servicemen went overseas and then came home, and some of them might have been treated in her hospital, because there was, she had no hesitation. She goes right in. She helps him get back to sleep, that kind of thing. And it says to me that she had some sort of experience dealing with GIs at that point. And it isn't ever explained in the movie. It's just one of those things that, how would she know to do that? Why wouldn't she wake up her mother? You know, that sort of thing.
I noticed that she had her car, when we see her, when she's smooching with Dana Andrews, her car has a red cross on the back window.
Yeah.
And I went,
ooh, nice detail.
Why? You know, why? There must have been a reason. I wondered why, maybe, I don't know. I'm just curious why there must have been a thing. And I thought, would it get
gasoline?
Would it get you through traffic?
Oh, yeah.
Gasoline.
Right. That makes sense. And also parking, right?
Yeah.
The hospital.
I thought parking, yeah, but gasoline, that's get you through the rationing, I would guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to answer Teresa Wright questions, her first movie was in 1941. It was The Little Foxes with Betty Davis, which is amazing. This is her sixth movie. She has made Pride of the Yankees. She's made Shadow of a Doubt. She's made Mrs. Miniver, which is Wyler's previous Oscar-winning big, well, that was a war-related film. So, yeah, Teresa Wright is kind of coming in hot as far as, you know, film roles.
Yeah, I was wondering if she, I think she had three Oscar nominations prior to this. After, I think with her several, maybe it was her first three movies. And I was wondering why she didn't get nominated for this. And maybe they were just sick of nominating her.
She's had enough.
And there were so many others. Everybody else got nominated. It's
like yeah, except for Dana Andrews, who never got nominated for anything.
Poor Dana Andrews.
Poor Dana Andrews. Yeah.
You know, Mickey pointed out something that I had never really specifically thought about. It's one of those things that, about this movie that I've kind of just loved without realizing it. And that is this sort of the fact that the movie trusts you to be able to put things together if you want to or if you need to, like about her, Teresa Wright's character being a nurse. We know she's a nurse, but the fact that she has the specific expertise to deal with his issues. And also, I found myself sort of wondering, like, you talked about how, you know, their dad, Al, is coming back and he's in a, you know, he was a lower rank than Fred Dairy, but Fred Dairy is sort of a lower rank in society. Interesting conflict there. But also the fact that when Fred asks, like, how long have you been married? And it's 20 years. And he's 20 years. Like, that really drives it home how much older Al is. And, like, the idea that why is he such an older man who has been, you know, who is in the, you know, an enlisted man, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we never get any information as to why any of these men went to war. Like, were they all just drafted? Did some of them volunteer? Did Al leave his family to, you know, did he sign up and go on purpose because he just wanted to, you know, go help with the war effort? Did he sign up on purpose because he wanted to get away from his family? Because we get that scene later where we hear how difficult, you know, it has been over the 20 years for Millie and Al to fall in love and fall out of love and hate each other and et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's a lot of blanks that are never quite filled in around the edges, which makes it a very interesting family dynamic for me to just sort of think about all of those different things. I think the Fred and Peggy romance is sort of the swooping, swelling romance thing that I love about this movie. But the interactions and the bits that I find, I think, the most relatable and that really truly hit me where I live are the family dynamics of the Stevenson family and Al coming home and trying to learn how to live again.
Yeah, and so everything you bring up, I hadn't even really put all this together before you mentioned it, but okay, so let's figure Al is 45 or so, and they've been married for 20 years. So they got married when he was 25. So if he's been overseas for 5 years, he went when he was 40. He's a banker. He leaves a wife and two children, somehow enlists or volunteers or whatever, had enough connections that he wasn't a private, but he didn't have a military background or maybe know anybody in the military. So he didn't get a high rank in the military, where Dana Andrews probably signed up and then worked his way up the ranks because he was a soda jerk. Mm-hmm. And then our third character, Harold Russell, he was probably a private, was in the wrong place at the wrong time, that kind of thing. But it's so interesting that Al would have left a very comfortable lifestyle to go to war. And he didn't have to go, I don't think. I mean, I don't think they were signing up 40-year-old men. They were signing up all the high school graduates and, you know, people that were sort of college age. So there's some stuff in there that we didn't ever hear the explanation for, and it would be very interesting to know.
And part of me wonders if that relates at all to William Wyler's own life experiences, which I know, Shelley, you referred to earlier.
So one last Teresa Wright tidbit for the people who are yelling at the screen or the iPod or whatever their iPod. Mm-hmm. Everybody's listening on an iPod, clearly. She was nominated for 3 Oscars, 2 in 1 year. She was nominated for her first film, The Little Foxes. Then she was nominated subsequently in the second year, 1 for Mrs. Miniver and 1 for Pride of the Yankees, 1 as supporting actor, 1 as lead actor, and she won for Mrs. Miniver. So the Academy was probably like, seriously, lady, mm-hmm. too much. But yeah, Wyler had just come back from war, and I might as well just throw this in now because Wyler is one of a number of Hollywood directors who had war experiences. He flew missions. He was a filmmaker in the war, but he was actually, you know, flying in airplanes and actually suffered a pretty significant hearing loss in the war and had fairly, I don't know that he had PTSD. I think he might have had some PTSD because after he got back from the war, he actually had some difficulty sort of getting back into directing, some of which had to do with hearing loss. It wasn't that they didn't want him. It's just that he had some trouble sort of getting back into it. There's a really excellent book called 5 Came Back, which was made into a TV series by Mark Harris, which talks about the war experiences of 5 directors, John Huston, John Ford, William Wyler. Why do I always forget the other two? But they're 5. Wow, I'm blanking on that. But they're 5 directors, all of whom had very different and very interesting World War II experiences. It's a really great book, and I would recommend it. And I'll put a link in the show notes. So let's talk a little bit about Dana Andrews and Virginia Mayo, i.e. Fred and not Bluesy. Ginger. What was her name? Susie? Bluesy. Fred Bluesy. There you go.
So she listens to jazz, so she's clearly a Bluesy.
And not a typical Virginia. Mayo played a lot of sort of sympathetic leading characters in this late 40s period. So this is probably a fun role for her because she got to wear a flashy wardrobe and she got to be kind of a jerk to Dana Andrews. Mm-hmm. And so he's been a soda jerk and he comes back from and he goes to war. And, you know, my little understanding of because he was, you know, a lot of people in planes were either, you know, low level enlisted people or they were officers who were actually flying the plane. And I know bombardiers and navigators were also officers, but they weren't necessarily pilots. But that's super interesting that that's what he ended up doing. I would assume he had either some interest or some aptitude for flying. But again, he's not a pilot. He's a bombardier. So, you know, what does that require? That requires perhaps some math, some calculating talent, some precision, a steady hand, that kind of thing. But you know, he comes back and basically he's the one where his war experience is immediately discounted by the manager of this drugstore chain, what used to be an independent drugstore that was bought up by a chain. And the guy says, yeah, I know you have all those ribbons. I know you were a captain. I know you were, you know, doing your best for the country, but none of that translates to actual experience that we can use in a drugstore. And he eventually gets hired on at the perfume counter and then he ends up back at the, you know, being a soda jerk, which it's a real incongruous thing to me. And I feel like some of my reaction to it is probably based on my own sort of coded thoughts about class, maybe in film and in life itself. And I'm like, well, why does he have to be a soda jerk? But he does. And that's what the movie is telling us. You know, he came back and the fact that he's a decorated soldier doesn't mean that he's going to have a cushy ride in terms of jobs.
And he even gets resented because he was in the Air Force. By others in the military. Mm. I had no idea there was that dichotomy that the Army folks thought that the Air Force was a bunch of glamour boys up there and that aren't facing the same war that they were.
Well, they were up above the war. So my dad was in the Army Air Corps and William Wyler was in the Army Air Corps. And I'm going to assume that Fred was in the Army Air Corps. And so they went in first. They went in and softened up all of these locations. And then the Army and the Marines, like if it was the Mediterranean, they went in afterwards. So if you think about Normandy, we don't hear about the bombers that went in first. We hear about all those guys that waded ashore. And they feel like they had the toughest jobs because they had to engage the Army on the ground where the flyboys were able to swoop in. You know, they were having combat up above too, but they were just going in, hopefully precisely dropping bombs and then swooping out, you know, so that did lead to an incredible amount of resentment. And also there was definitely segregation within the Army because Black folks could serve in the infantry and some other areas, but they were not really in the Army Air Corps. The Tuskegee Airmen were a separate unit, but they were not part of the regular Army Air Corps.
Oh, I was thinking Air Force, but Air Force wasn't around yet.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't created until after World War II.
Yeah, I think right at the very end of World War II. But yeah, it was all Army Air Corps. I mean, then there were Navy flyers too, but yeah. Most of it was.
We didn't really have the aircraft carriers that we know of now.
Right.
Those were in their infancy during World War II.
Oh, I just wanted to, speaking of the war, just it's so amazing how this was. They started filming this, I think, 7 months after the war ended, and how they were managed to put all this together in such a quick time period after the war and capture all these different threads of what was going on. It's been such an amazing time capsule that they put together so quickly.
Mm-hmm. I was interested, because Homer was in the Navy and he actually worked on an aircraft carrier. He was on, he describes it as a CV, which I didn't know what that meant. I had to look it up, and it's just a generic aircraft carrier designation. So I do like the touch that each one of these men comes from a very different experience. Like Homer, we have Al, who, as we already said, had been in hand-to-hand combat and had actually, like, you know, killed people himself, sort of personally. And then Fred is dropping bombs from up above. And then Homer never actually even saw any battles. He was a mechanic, and he was injured in an explosion on the aircraft carrier that he was on. He never actually got to see anything except for, you know, this below decks sort of room. And yet they all had this, you know, a similar experience trying to reintegrate and recognizing that all of these different experiences, yes, they were different, but it still was completely, completely different from what everybody back on the home front was going through. And easing back into that lifestyle is not as easy as they were expecting or hoping.
Dana Andrews' character, as we mentioned before, is the one who shows PTSD symptoms. Initially, the Homer character was going to not be physically disabled, but was going to have PTSD. And he was going to be played by Farley Granger, who you might remember from Strangers on a Train, if you've mm-hmm. seen that movie. And Wyler wanted to change it. The source material is, this was a story that was in Time magazine, which was adapted into a novel, which was then adapted into this movie by Robert Sherwood, who was a fairly well-known author of not only screenplays but plays, and had done actually a number. He had just completed a semi-successful play about post-war experiences that was on Broadway. And the only reason I know about that is because I'm a Spencer Tracy fan and he was in it. It was called The Rugged Path. But Sherwood did a whole lot of other things. This is not the sort of film that where tons of things were changed between the original material and the film. But I guess the main one is just that because Wyler knew of this guy, Harold Russell, who was, in fact, a veteran who had lost his hands in the war. And Wyler went and found him and said, no, I want to put him in this movie. He was a non-professional actor, ends up going on to win Best Supporting Actor. So, you know, one for one. Good for you. that was the change. And so I guess some of that PTSD stuff came Dana Andrews' way. And I think that ends up being a good choice for Dana Andrews' character, as well as for, I'll talk a little bit later about sort of my take on Harold Russell and his representation of disability. Spoiler alert, I like it. But I think Dana Andrews and the way the PTSD is sort of integrated but doesn't overwhelm his life, I think is a really good touch for the film. And he has troubles in his marriage with Virginia Mayo. It's interesting because he married her right before he went into the Army. Apparently and this is another thing they don't sort of expiate directly. But he says he met her in Texas when he's in training, right? Mm-hmm. So she would have come to live with his parents in Cincinnati or in Boone City. Mm-hmm. And his parents live in this sort of railroad flat kind of place. They're not very well off. And she lives with them and moves out so that she can presumably have her own space. And then also so she can goes to get a job at a nightclub. So she's living independently in an apartment, doing her own thing. And the parents are not in contact with her. And on some level, you can kind of get that because she's just moved across the country. She doesn't know these people. She barely knows the guy she married. And then all of a sudden, she's living in reduced circumstances with them, waiting for, maybe she didn't get along with them, whatever, waiting for her husband to come home. And then, but it seems that the thing that precipitates the breakup of their marriage, because she's happy to see him when he comes home, is that he's not able or willing, really able, to take a job that gives him a high income and lets her live in the lifestyle she's become accustomed to. And he makes her quit her job, which is the point at which I'm like, come on, Dana Andrews. Really? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes, really.
Because it's 1946 and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, well, somebody earlier mentioned how he's just like this. I think it was you, Shelley, about how he has a good deal of confidence and stuff coming back from the war. And I think he just had this picture of the white picket fence and the house in the country. And her working for herself doesn't fit into that picture. And he just absolutely like cuts it off at the knees. And, you know, it's... I knew from the moment that he said, I think even the first time I saw this movie, that he said that, you know, he married her right before, you know, when he's in training, right before he left, he didn't even have a whole year with her. I was like, oh, that's not going to go very well, because obviously they don't even know each other. And yeah, I think they were setting that up pretty clearly and pretty elegantly for a fall right from the beginning. Because yeah, if I had married a man that I barely knew and then had to completely upend my life and move many states away to live in a really, you know, not very nice circumstances with two people that I don't know, that's going to be super awkward. I would want to go get a job and move out too.
So it's implied, although never, you know, openly, but that she's has boyfriends. That yeah. She
I wouldn't do that part.
Yeah. Right, no, that's the bad part. And he doesn't even, they have the conflict. And then it's like the guy that later on we meet, Cliff, is clearly a boyfriend of some kind. But it's implied before that she does. But it is possible as a viewer to not believe that. It's possible to believe that she just is having a more independent life. And especially because he's not allowed her to work, that she is resentful of that, because that the sort of relationship with others is not really addressed. Except she does like, I mean, she likes to party. She likes to go out. Mm-hmm. She knows people at nightclubs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, she might have been like Gilda, you know, speaking of another podcast episode, where she was just someone who loved the nightlife and wanted to go out and had a circle of friends, quote unquote. But there wouldn't have been any men around, which or at least
not age appropriate men,
able bodied men around. So she would have had to maybe go out with the guys that were were 4F or the older guys that didn't go out. And I just got this sense that she didn't just sit home when she right. was waiting for him, but she thought he was a status symbol because here he was a fly boy, a guy in the Army Air Corps, and he took her picture with him, and she had all these exploits that, you know, she could probably tell people about. And then he comes home and he's just this guy that she doesn't really know, who tells her to quit her job. And she's already seen that his parents live in reduced circumstances. And I think it's starting to dawn on her that she's not going to be able to have this lifestyle anymore. So I think she played it very well. I mean, we want to hate her in a sense and think that she's this unfaithful floozy. And yet you do get a sense of it from her perspective too. It's just that this is a very patriotic time, and you know, the women folk were supposed to voluntarily give up their jobs and let the men go back to the factories and things like that, you know, to help them get all settled in. And she's kind of balking at that, which I think that's an interesting note. Yeah.
And there's a way in which the movie doesn't like her specifically for that. I mean, you find out that there are other reasons when she's clearly not faithful to Fred or interested in Fred. But the movie also basically is saying on some level, she should be waiting for him with her hands crossed in her lap and be ready to do whatever he needs her to do in order for the relationship to. And I've sort of conflicted feelings about that, because she ends up being a villain, and Andrew's chemistry with Teresa Wright, who he's meant to be with, because that's the romantic element of the movie, is so good. You're just like, oh, I want them together because they're so sweet, even though Virginia Mayo, probably a lot of fun if that was what he was up for at that time.
I just had a theory that, you know, she would be fooling around with the guys that were still left back there in Boone City, and one of them is of course Fred's boss, Sticky, back at the drugstore.
Right.
So maybe
Sticky
and Marie.
Oh, that is headcanon I can 100% accept, but I'm not sure I enjoy it.
K-I-S-S-I-N-G, behind the perfumes.
That's upsetting.
Wow. You know, I don't know if it's me bringing my 21st century viewpoint to it, but I felt like, especially watching it this time, that the movie was more even-handed than I remembered in terms of she's kind of a villain, but that, you know, this movie really doesn't have villains.
Right.
And that she really does explain herself very well. That, you know, yes, she's maybe not being faithful to him, and that is not great, you know, no matter how you slice it, because they clearly don't have an openly polyamorous relationship, so, you know, not okay. But she explains herself and points out, like, you know, you made me quit my job, and I feel like it's a little bit more evenly matched in terms of who is at fault than I remembered from earlier times. I think the first time that I watched this, I remembered her as being just a very clear-cut harlot who, you know, I just didn't like. And now I certainly don't feel that way. I feel like, honestly, it's the war that is to blame for this situation. They both jumped into a hasty marriage because patriotism, like, you know, my beautiful soldier is running off to war and, you know, I need to give him something to remember me by. And then in the end, it just doesn't work out great. And I think not only is that, you know, like, it sad and unfortunate, but it's another nice bit of the social commentary on what the war has done to society in general. Like, not every relationship that started off beforehand is going to make it afterwards. And that, you know, even at the beginning of the movie, the first time I saw it, I wasn't entirely sure what was going to happen to the Stevensons. Like, were they going to be able to make it through him coming back? So you get a lot of different flavors of reintegration into society. And I appreciate this one being a little bit more, I don't know. She seems less and less of a clear-cut black and white villain every time I watch this movie.
The only thing I thought about her is I wish the character is so broadly portrayed as this kind of floozy character, mm-hmm. and just how she dresses and how she acts and she listens to jazz and all these things. If she'd been a little more subtle, she's just such a sharp contrast to, you know, Peaches and Cream and Teresa Wright. that I feel like I love the performance. It's fun to watch, but it's a little much.
Well, again, I think it must have been fun for the actress.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're Virginia Mayo and you're sort of playing B picture leading ladies, and her career, you know, was kind of picking up at that time, but she was, you know, destined to play sort of nice girl leads. This had to have been a lot of fun, and the wardrobe had to have been great for her too.
Yeah, she maybe even went a little bit bigger with the performance simply because it was such a contrast to what she was used to doing. And maybe if she had reined it in a little bit, it would have, because it definitely stands out as the biggest performance, I think, of the movie. And maybe it's a little bit jarring just simply because of that. It doesn't quite mesh.
Because we're talking about this set of characters, I want to quickly mention one specifically of Dana Andrews' parents, Gladys George, an actress I adore. She is 45 years old in this movie. She's playing Dana Andrews' mother. She's considerably older. Her performance in The Roaring Twenties is one of my favorite things ever. She's like the woman with the saloon singer with a heart of gold who's in love with James Cagney. And then she's also in The Maltese Falcon, so you would have seen her as Iva Archer. And she is in, well, one of my sort of weird obsessions is movies that have been remade multiple times. And there's a movie called Madam X that's been made a bunch of times. And she did the 1937 version of that. Someday I'll dare to do a Madam X marathon on LTS. But in any case, I adore Gladys George. And Hortense is her character name. She doesn't have a lot to do. And I think the old lady wig is unfortunate. But I do enjoy the small performance that she has. Yay, Gladys George.
Yeah, I wanted to see more of her. And I guess she was playing a stepmother. And I was curious why they made that decision. But
did they say that? I missed that.
He refers to her by her first name and he refers to his dad as Pop. So it's clear that
I thought that was just like a family sort of.
I didn't read it that way.
Thing. I don't know. Okay.
Like, no, I thought that she was his stepmother. And
oh, interesting.
That was mm-hmm. One of the reasons why he seemed a little stiff and formal around his parents. I mean, around them. I mean, he's come back from the war, for goodness sake, and he just drops in and leaves and then goes back to get stuff and then leaves. And then the father's reading Hortense, you know, but he doesn't seem to have much of a relationship with them. And considering that he's been gone for 3 or 4 years and in great danger, you would think that there would be, you know, more hugging or at least sit down and have coffee with us or something like that.
This is another family dynamic that that also sort of, you know, left some blanks to sort of be wondered about or to be filled in. And I also found myself doing that here, thinking that, you know, especially the very first scene that we see his pop in, like he's got a bottle in his hand. And my first thought was, oh, okay, his dad is an alcoholic and he's got a drinking problem. But that never really, you know, that may be the case, but nothing ever particularly comes of that. But the this is an area where I think the performances led me down a road of headcanon where nothing in the text of the film actually says it specifically. So like the way that he says Hortense and Pop made me think, okay, this is a stepmother. The way that he said, you know, to her, take care of him, like take care of my pops. That did not read to me the way that a son would say something like that to a mother. That's a son saying that to, you know, somebody who he is not related to, who clearly loves his dad. And then the fact that there every interaction that he has with his dad, it's like you can tell that they care about each other so much and neither one of them knows how to express it either verbally or physically. Like you can almost see them like almost wanting like it's like they almost want to hug each other, but that doesn't seem to be their relationship. So my headcanon immediately spun off into, okay, this is a family that has never had a lot in terms of financial resources. It's been tough getting by. He had a job as a soda jerk. His parents don't have a lot of money. Who knows what happened to his actual mother? Did she die? Did she just leave? We don't know. But to me, it read as he had a tough time growing up and going away into, they had never had a really strong, solid, stable effusive relationship with his dad and his parents. So when he went away and became, you know, a little bit more big man on campus and being very good at his job and getting all these citations and stuff, coming back and having to, like, the very first interactions that he has after he leaves his fellow soldiers is with his family that he's not particularly comfortable interacting with. And, you know, that's it seems to strike him as a dash of cold water in that, oh, wow, like this is really a little bit of the old times, especially because he's expecting his wife to be there and she's not there. So, you know, that could have been a little bit of grease in the social wheels and he doesn't even have that. So he's really put on the back foot because he's not getting what he expected and he's having to sort of slide into this what seems to be a relationship that was never particularly as warm and open as, you know, obviously the Stevensons are. They talk about everything.
Yes, what's that line? We talk about things. It's like, yeah. Okay.
Well, might be corny. And I was like, it is corny, yeah. But it's also
it
great.
It is corny. Right. It's adorable. And it works. It's good for movies because people who don't talk about things in movies just have to sort of look sullenly at one another.
Or talk to themselves.
Yes. Well, let's talk about Homer's story. Homer is a petty officer from the Navy who so that means he did get promoted a little bit ahead of being a private. He comes home and for some reason I remembered Homer as more of a working class archetype, but he comes home to a pretty leafy looking suburban house. And they don't seem to be, you know, well off, but they don't seem to be impoverished by any means. And that's really not part of
his
story.
He was literally big man on campus because he like.
Yeah, he was a football player.
Football player, right. Played basketball. He's got some wrestling pictures, I think.
Right. And he comes home with hooks for steel hooks in place of hands. His hands have been burned off, as Mickey mentioned before. It wasn't a direct war-related accident. It wasn't bombed, but his it was a burned incident. Well, he wasn't in combat, shall we say. He was working below decks, and then he came out, and that's when it happened. But it means that he has these hooks. He has been given enough rehab that he apparently is quite proficient in using them. There are all sorts of scenes in which both he and the people around him are figuring out how to address the situation. He's got a girl, literally a girl next door he's in love with that was going to get married to, and he's got parents who love him and a little kid sister. And so he comes back to this world where he's the first one who has trepidation about, you know, going home. And unlike a lot of movies of this era where somebody comes back with a disability, at least his family knows about it, because I've seen that in a couple movies where the person comes back and they're forced to come home and they're missing an arm or a limb or something like that. And they didn't haven't even bothered to tell anybody. And they wonder why people have surprised reactions. But Homer has managed to inform his family. So even though his mother, you know, bursts into tears when she first sees him, and there are a fair number of awkward reactions, we've addressed it, right? It's been addressed beforehand, which I think is great for the movie. And I think it shorthands it. It provides us an opportunity to just react provides all the characters an opportunity to react in real time, as opposed to having to go back and, you know, dredge up, oh my God, this is not a thing I knew about. And as a portrayal of disability and how you cope with new disability, I really like it. I really like the parts. He's a non-professional actor, as we mentioned before. The parts of his performance that I like, I think, are both sourced from the screenplay and from the direction. He's a guy with a disability who also has an inner life and who thinks about things. And he's defined by his disability to some extent, and he's not searching for a job as the other characters are. It's pointed out that he has a pension from the government, a disability benefits from the government. So it's interesting whether he will ever choose to try and find some work. But he's thinking about things, and his conflict is he doesn't want to burden Wilma, the Kathy O'Donnell character, with his disability. And we have a scene a little later on where that's just beautifully explained and dealt with. But as a portrayal of disability that has subtlety and has different aspects, I really enjoyed it.
I want to point out something, because you said, you know, he doesn't want to burden her, which, I mean, is true. But actually, I feel like the crux of the idea is not so much that he doesn't want to burden her, is that he is not optimistic enough to trust that she is actually going to truly love him after this, and that he doesn't want to hold her to a promise she made when before he went to war, before he lost his hands. And I know that's a subtle distinction, but that, I think, to me is an indication of how well fleshed out this character is. You're right, Shelley. He does have an inner life, and he does think about things. So it's not just, oh dear, I don't want to be a burden to you. It's, do you actually still care about me in the first place, because I also don't want to be in a loveless marriage where you are just duty bound to help.
I agree. I think that's an important distinction that I probably should have made, because as you were speaking, I was thinking, there were a lot of indications of that, because the whole I don't want to burden you thing is pretty unsubtle, and it's done a lot.
Yeah. So I just looked something up about the Navy and rehab during World War II. Because I think this indicates something about his family. So obviously, this is the first time his mother is seeing him since he was injured. They had a naval rehab hospital that they built in Yosemite. And family visits were encouraged. There were tents that families could rent and visit their wounded naval people while they were going through rehab. And the pictures are amazing, because it's like a gigantic resort hotel, but they emptied the whole thing out and put bed after bed after bed on the grounds of it, so that these guys could go through their therapy. And so the family wasn't wealthy enough for them to make the trip, but you know, they're wealthy. There's enough wealth that they're living in this lovely middle class bungalow neighborhood, but not wealthy enough, or maybe it was too complicated to actually get up to Yosemite and visit. I mean, if it's Cincinnati, it would have been quite a long haul to go up and visit Homer.
Also, lot of middle-class families, especially later, were stretched thin just to keep up that middle-class lifestyle. So, potentially they couldn't afford it simply because they have the house with all of the greenery and the nice car and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and who knows what they did. I mean, maybe his mother worked during the war. I don't know what his father would have done during. Do we know what his father did for a living?
I don't think so.
We don't know what their income was like during the war. And he would have gotten some kind of pay. I think they continued to get paid after they were injured, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he probably would have sent his allotment check home, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So. It's really interesting how they focus a lot on how he uses the hooks, and that even creates a bit of suspense, because you're watching, you're kind of, I felt kind of rapt just watching him use them and hoping he doesn't, he does drop a glass at some point, but it's just really intriguing to see how adept he is in with those. And also, he actually won 2 Oscars. They gave him an honorary Oscar, thinking that he wasn't going to win for supporting actress.
I love that actor. So
they ended up being a non-professional actor. They didn't think he would win, but he did win, and then he got the honorary Oscar also.
Yeah, the glass scene, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because to me that is a wonderful little example of the types of things that a family needs to learn to think about when they're living with somebody who has a disability that is new to them. You know, later on, so they're sort of like, you know, they're not wine glasses, but they're sort of curvy and they've got a stem at the bottom. And that's not the best kind of glass to try to grip with some hooks. And especially when you're kind of nervous and a little bit shaky, I think under other circumstances, he probably could have handled it okay. But later on, we see him going downstairs to get a glass of milk, and there are glasses sitting right there. But the glass that he picks up is not one of those types of glasses. It is just a regular, like, you know, kind of tall juice glass, milk glass that does not have curves and is much more fitted to that. Knowing a number of people who have multiple different types of disabilities and who have, you know, gotten them at different points in their lives, the types of things that you need to learn to think about as you move forward with adapting to a new situation like that is something that I had not really thought about before my life experience sort of brought it to me. And I love how this movie, just in that one particular scene and then bringing him a different glass later, is just like a nice little like, oh, yeah, these are some things that we need to change. And he talks about how he won't be able to get out of the bedroom if the door happens to go shut. Like, you know, that's probably something that they will be able to adapt to later on as they continue to think about this. But they just haven't gotten to that stage yet, in part because he's keeping to himself because he's so scared of how everybody else feels about him that he's not opened up to actually talk about it and help them make those changes.
But see, that's the argument for having an actor who actually has a disability. I don't know how they made the choices they did with the business he does, but I can guarantee you that what he could and couldn't do was actually based on what the actor could and couldn't do. Yep. And so those subtleties are very specific and very individual. And I'm sure the director said, we want you to succeed at a lot of things, but we want to see you not succeed at something just so that we can see how your character reacts or how other characters react. And so the actor was able to say, well, this is easy for me, because there are a lot of things he does that if you hadn't really thought about it, if you saw somebody with 2 hooks for hands for the first time, there are a lot of things he does that a non-disabled person could be pretty amazed by that for him, as somebody who's gone through rehab, are probably pretty straightforward, like carrying a bag. Like, you can put a hook around the handle of a bag, and if you still have the arm strength required to heft it, it's probably not that difficult. Pouring the glass of milk, more challenging, especially based on what kind of glass you have. Mm-hmm. And like you say, with the door, you know, once he and Wilma get married, spoiler alert, they can hopefully outfit their house in such a way that those specific situations in which he has a limitation can be addressed.
So I'm looking up how the actor Harold Russell actually got injured, and he was injured June 6, 1944. Was that D-Day? Was that 44?
That's D-Day.
Yeah,
I don't know if he was in D-Day, but
he was. He was teaching demolition work at a camp in North Carolina, and it says a defective fuse detonated the TNT explosives he was handling. Just thinking about how recent that was, I was thinking maybe the actor had been injured earlier in the war, but he was injured just toward the very end of the war. So he had only been using these hooks as hands, I think, a couple years when this was filmed, and becoming used to that too. That's pretty amazing that it was so new to him that and he was able to adjust, at least physically, so well.
The other thing I like about the way they wrote the character and the story about his disability is that there are a variety of reactions. It's not that everybody in his family is freaked out. It's not that everybody is accepting. It's not that and he himself has different reactions. There's sometimes when you might call him defensive or I can do this. There are other times at which he's embarrassed. There are other times at which he's completely confident. There's no rule about who reacts how. And so you get to process it in a number of different ways as a viewer. And I like that so much because all of the people involved, even the well-meaning ones, the ones that love him and he himself, are going to go through different feelings about what's happening at different times. And it's not going to be consistent and it's going to be confusing. And I love that. I love the way that that nuance was handled. So I don't even want to get into, well, should his mother have burst into tears or should this have happened at this particular time? There were a lot of different experiences that they're talking about here. And the fact, too, that there are a number of scenes where his hooks are quite prominent, like in the scene when he gets married, the way they shoot it, it's from chest height. And you see Wilma and Homer standing there together and the officiant is in front of them. And he raises his hooks up and he's going to put the ring on her finger. And the hooks are in the foreground. And just the way they sort of, but they're not, you know, they're expressed, they're physically a benefit. They're a manifestation of his physical being, but they're not like, look, I have hooks. They're just like, they're part of him. And I just, there are a lot of other scenes like that where he's actually using the hooks. Obviously you see them, but there are other scenes where they raise them in such a way that just in the way that you would see somebody's hands. And I just love that. I love the way it was photographed for the most part.
And I was intrigued about how people shake hands with him. You know, the soldiers know how to kind of shake his forearm, but other people don't. And so that was a real subtle thing that was that I noticed.
Yeah.
Well, I have had that experience because I one of my uncles worked for the phone company and as a lineman. And there are a lot of people who get injured doing that kind of work. And I went to an anniversary party of his and I met a guy who had worked with him and he was introduced me. This is a guy I know from work. And I reached out. I'm a teenager at this point, and I reach out to shake his hand and he's got a hook. And I don't know what to do. And I found myself like grabbing onto the sleeve of his jacket. And so I saw that and I was like, I get that. I have been to that exact place. And he smiled at me and I'm a kid. And so, you know, no harm, no foul, I guess. But it was a very familiar experience.
And watching this movie for the first time, when they're in some sort of outbuilding or the garage, and he has the gun and he's target shooting, I started thinking, is he going to make it through this movie? And yeah, it created a kind of suspense. I thought, well, surely he's not going to kill himself, but you know, but it makes the movie more visceral because you're not quite sure how far this is going to go.
Well, what's interesting about that is, you know, he's in the Navy, so he probably didn't have a gun on him when he was serving, but he had been a hunter as a kid, and so he's thinking about it as a way to express, can I still do this, right? Do I still have the dexterity with these hooks to do a thing that I used to do? He's probably learning about himself in that moment.
But the idea that it is a weapon that's able to take somebody's life very easily, it does add that moment of frisson as to, like, you know, and even when, you know, his lovely girl next door comes and finds out that, like, he's shooting, like, she, you can tell on her face, she's a little bit worried about the same thing that we as the audience are.
Yeah. And I want to talk about the scene where we learn about how he basically gets ready for bed, the two scenes, which I think are so masterfully photographed. So there is a scene with his father where he goes to his father and he says, I'm ready for bed. And his father comes in and it's shot from his shoulder so that you see him taking down what look like suspenders and helping him put his pajama shirt on and getting him into bed. But you don't see the full, you don't actually know what's happening. You know that the father is helping him, but you don't really see the fullness of it. And then toward the end, where he and Wilma are sort of making their peace and talking about being married, he says, I want you to basically see this. So come upstairs. And she does it. And you see the full experience. It's a harness that has his hooks attached to it. And it's taken off. And he explains how it works. And that's when he explains, these are the things, once these hands are gone, once these hooks are gone, I'm missing some capabilities. I can't get out of a door. I can't do this. I can't do that. And he's basically saying, this is what life would be like. And it's a beautiful scene. Just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I almost thought that her character was a little too heroic. I wanted to see her maybe struggle a little more. with this before. She just seemed a little too perfect.
She wasn't as, I feel, fully developed as some of the other characters in the movie, which I think is why I keep forgetting about her character entirely. Because, everybody else is sort of struggling with something related to either coming back from war or the people who are coming back from war. And she never really does struggle. She's sad that he won't talk to her. But, she's never really wrestling with anything other than uncertainty about whether he actually cares for her anymore. Right. But I mean, maybe she's supposed to be just like this bright-eyed, young girl who is just so, so in love that nothing is going to distract her from that whatsoever.
And also, she does say that they want to send her away. And she doesn't want to go. This is her guy. She's made up her mind. They probably met in high school and he was older and the hero and the sports hero and all that. And this is just like the Carters, like Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. I mean, this was just her guy. And it didn't matter whether he came back with hooks or not. And I do think that does show a little bit of her character, that she wasn't as docile as everybody thinks that she was.
That's true. Yeah, that she took it into her own hands to actually, leave home. She's looking out the window. Oh, I see those lights on. I'm going across the way because I don't want to do what my parents are saying to me. So that's true. That's a good point.
I mean, they could have written her so that she had unrealistic expectations. Like they could have said, she could have said, it's going to be fine. And then he shows her something that causes her to go, I didn't really realize. But they didn't do that. And it feels like a minor thing to me. Yeah, I agree. She's less well-developed. I will say my little piece about Kathy O'Donnell, though. She didn't have a long career. She made a couple of film noirs that I really like, one called Side Street and one called They Live by Night. They Live by Night is probably the most romantic film noir. It's her and Farley Granger, and they're this sort of idyllic young couple who at the same time is caught up in this terrible crime spree thing. And it's just, someday we'll watch that. It's one of those movies that but most people who I have on the panel haven't seen. Yeah. And so either people will go, I love it, thank you. Or they'll go, what have you gotten me into? But that's happened before. So they Live by Night, coming to an LTS episode near you with Kathy O'Donnell. Side Street, also pretty good.
While we're talking about these characters and other actors in other things, I want to take my moment to talk about a mother figure and mention Dorothy Adams and how much I love her. I had forgotten she was in this movie and I saw her and I was just delighted. She's the mother of Catherine, Kathy. I've forgotten her name already. Oh my gosh. So terrible.
Wilma.
Kathy Wilma. O'Donnell's yeah. Mom. See, Kathy O'Donnell is the actress, of course. But yes. So, we have Dorothy Adams as Mrs. Cameron, her mother, who, her reaction, she's not in it a ton. It's a very small part that tends to be, she gets small parts. I think my favorite role of hers is Bessie in Laura as the maid that just loves Laura so much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. That's great. That's a good catch. I had not made that.
Uh-huh. And she has, it's a little bit of a similar performance in that of being very intense, feeling very intense things. And here she's just trying so hard to be positive about things. And her husband is not really on the same page with her quite as much. Obviously she cares about her daughter and just wants everything to go back to normal as soon as possible. So it was just nice to see her.
So many people in good roles, even small ones. So let's talk about cinematography. This movie was shot by Greg Toland, who did Citizen Kane, among many other movies, and he is known for Deep Focus. What's amazing to me about a movie like this is that it's a domestic movie, right? We're in towns, we're in living rooms, we're in nightclubs. We're not in noir shadows, so it's not the kind of movie you would normally think about in terms of its cinematography. But there are so many great moments. And I think, Randy, you wanted to talk about one of those.
Yeah, there's a moment when Hoagie Carmichael is at the piano with Homer. I think they're playing Chopsticks. And you see Al standing there. And he, at first, I thought he was just kind of staring into the distance because he was lost in thought. But then through the deep focus, you see Dana Andrews way in the background and in a phone booth, and you can barely see what he's, you can't really see his expression or what's happening. But that's really through that deep focus approach that really struck me as a how it kind of manipulated me and just changed what I thought was going on.
Do you know who Dana Andrews is in that phone booth talking to?
He's talking to he's talking to Teresa,
to Peggy.
Right?
He's talking to Peggy, which I didn't clock until I read an article about this movie where they mentioned that scene. And it didn't occur to me until I read that. Oh, that's when he breaks up with her, because it's referenced in the movie. Because he's had this talk with Frederick March, who's Peggy's father. Mm-hmm. And he's basically saying, this cannot go well. And so Dana Andrews goes and he breaks up with her over the phone.
Yeah.
And basically says, yeah.
The moment it works so well for me because they have it out. It's this, amazingly, there's a two shot of the booth and then close ups of their faces. And both men are not happy. And like he orders coffee and he never takes a single sip of that coffee. And I'm like, oh, no. And then he pays for the drinks because it's just an FU kind of a move. The drinks are on me. And he's about to leave and he walks toward the door. And then as he's almost at the door, he stops and looks to his left and realizes there's a phone booth there. And he's like, I'm just going to do this right away. So he goes in with this determined look on his face, just as you have Homer then coming in and, seeing Butch and being like, oh, yeah, your friend's back there. And he comes back and poor Al is all distracted. And then we move over to the framing of the scene that Randy was talking about, which I also love. And the fact that, you have Al staring off and being, pretty distracted from what is a really awesome thing that's happening in front of him. Homer was really taking piano lessons. That wasn't a joke. And he just seems so happy and free as he's doing it. And he and Butch are just, going to town and having a good time. And it's just like there are two really strongly emotional things happening in that scene at the same time. And one of them is right up there in your face. And the other one is just so perfectly framed off to the left where you can still see Fred in focus on the phone and you can see Dana Andrews acting his little heart out and he is not having a happy time having this conversation. And then it's all capped off by the fact that he leaves and Homer sees him and he's like, hey Fred, and he's just out the door and Al has to be like, oh no, he just had to get back to the counter. I just love this movie so much.
It's such a great example of you have three characters, three separate stories. They are coming together in a scene, but it's not, okay, we're all going to sit around and have dinner. I mean, as they do, there are other scenes where they're all together. But multiple things are happening. They're each in different frames of mind. They're each focusing on things other than each other. It's a great scene. And I think it's easy to sort of, if you're not paying attention, not get all of those things. But
or if you haven't seen the movie a whole bunch of times.
Well, that's true, too. I think you're right. I watched it differently this time than I would have, the first three or four times I might have seen it.
The drugstore, the cinematography in the drugstore must have been very challenging. And I think they had a deep focus when the fight happens, when Dana punches out the jerk. And then you have a shot where you see the boss up in his office.
Yeah, in the window. Mm-hmm. And there's another example of it at the end during the wedding scene where, you have the couple sort of framed on the right side of the frame, looking to the right side of the frame. And you have Dana Andrews, who is looking back toward the back of the room where Teresa Wright is standing. And everything is in focus and yes. You have this beautiful wedding happening right here, but you also have an amazingly romantic moment happening with these other two characters who are at completely different spots, just looking at each other.
There's a lot going on. That's because you see Teresa Wright standing with her parents and the brother is nowhere to be seen, by the way. Sorry, Rob.
That's right. Oh, no.
Of course, my initial thought was, well, why did Teresa Wright go to the wedding? Did she really know Homer all that well? But then I thought, no, she should be at the wedding because she has to be with Dana Andrews. But Rob is
not
there.
He didn't know
but
him.
You see all of our characters framed at different perspectives and at different points of view. And again, like in the very foreground of that scene, you see the couple and you see Homer manipulating his hooks in order to put a ring on the woman's, on Kathy O'Donnell's
finger.
And
you get a little worried about it, too. It's like, oh, he better not drop it. I think everybody else in the scene is also seems to be a little bit worried.
And he actually takes, he takes the ring in between his hooks and sort of like taps it on the top of her finger a couple of times as if to say, see, don't worry, I got it. I got it. It's tight. And
I was wondering if he practiced. I like to imagine that he practiced either or with his mom or somebody like, hey, I really want to try because I want to do this right. This is important.
Yep.
So I just want to mention before the breakup scene, Peggy, I love her character, but she comes in. I think they had kissed in the parking lot. Am I right?
Yes.
The parking lot was very crowded and she needed to get her car out and he follows her and then they kiss in the parking lot. And then she goes home and her parents are sitting there and she says, he's miserable. I'm going to break up that marriage.
Oh, yeah. That's after they had gone out for the evening.
Right. And she said, and there are her parents who we know have been together for 20 years. Who or more who've been through everything together. Is her mother has to, you know, put her dad to bed when he's drunk and that sort of thing. And she just comes in and says, this is the guy I want. I'm going to break up that marriage. And her father, first of all, probably at this point knows that, you know, he's from the other side of the tracks or next to the tracks. And despite his rank, he doesn't think he has any prospects. He knows that he's married. I mean, this is 1946, and there were divorces going on all around because these people had folks had come back from the war and realized that they were ill matched and that sort of thing. But this is not the guy that, in theory, he wants for his daughter. Yeah. He doesn't know him well enough yet, and he just like his daughter, who's been working in this hospital during the war, is like hearing her say that because nice girls from nice families didn't go around being homewreckers. And so I just like to think of her determination and him instantly reacting to that and deciding, okay, I am putting a stop to this. And then that kind of precedes the scene with the beautiful setting in. And to me, it just says that that's an example of the world changing, that before World War II, that would have absolutely been his reaction. He absolutely would have broken them up. Nobody would have understood why she would have been interested in this guy. And he would have been expected to make his marriage work. And he's like, no, I'm not going to be married to her. I want a shot at happiness with this nice young lady. And the nice young lady is all for it. And it does nicely get wrapped up at the wedding.
Mm-hmm. And it also gives a little bit of flavor with the family dynamic as well, because really it takes a special kind of family for a daughter to feel comfortable going in and telling her parents, I am going to be a homewrecker. This is my plan.
I love the way that scene is written, because even despite what Al does in the next scene, he says, well, obviously he's got to go talk to Fred. But in the moment, they're not unreasonable. They treat her as an adult. I mean, just the line she says, I'm going to break it up. And it's just like, oh my God, little Teresa Wright is going to go break up a marriage. it's such a delightful scene. And it's the payoff for earlier when they said, we talk about things, which is a thing you say, but like, oh yeah, apparently they do. That family. Mm-hmm. Other photography that I like in the movie so much is that we talked about the aerial scene near the beginning where the three men are in the plane coming into Boone City and we see all the overhead shots of the football stadium and the high school. And as even before they get to Boone City, it's just a great shorthand for we're back in America and all these things are familiar to us because they are American. And as they get closer to home, they're seeing things that they recognize. They're all three sitting in the nose of the plane. We never see the pilot of the plane. The pilot doesn't even have to tell them get out. Cause they're allowed to be up there. Cause like, you know, special,
they know,
they know. Right. But it's just beautifully shot because you see it not only from their point of view at some times, but you also see it from behind their heads. So you get most of the screen filled with the view that they're seeing. And then you also see their faces doing reaction shots and reactions to one another. It's a lovely scene. And then of course the one near the end where Dana Andrews is in this, and there's the one near the end is a callback because one of the things we see is the airport where all of these junked planes are for military planes that we don't know what's going to happen to them, but for some reason they're all at this airport. And then that's where Dana Andrews goes toward the very end of the movie and sees all these planes and walks through them. And only after he's been in a bomber and had a PTSD experience does a guard say, hey, why don't you get out? What are you doing up there in the plane? And he's very patient with him. There's no, you know, he's allowed to climb around in the airfield all he wants until he isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot. Like, speaking of the sort of point of view-ish shot from behind them looking out, there's so much filming people from behind in this movie, and it is fascinating and wonderful. Like, you know, you don't get any of those sitcom dinner scenes where, for some reason, everybody is crowded around the opposite side of the table.
Right.
I mean, technically you do, because Rob is not there for breakfast with the Stevensons, and you have, you know, three people around the table, and that's fine. That makes perfect sense. But there are a whole bunch of other shots where almost the entire scene takes place with the camera shooting people sort of over their shoulders. I'm thinking of the later part of the scene where Wilma is helping Homer with his hooks and taking them off. They sit down on the bed, and they are facing away from us. I mean, they're facing toward each other, but they're, you know, if they were to look straight ahead, their backs would be to the camera. And it just, it felt so natural to not have, you know, they're not going to break the 180 degree rule and suddenly have some shots from the wrong side of the bed, so to speak. And they're having this conversation that is a little bit tentative and very emotional, and they are both very slow, you know, they're trying to open up to each other, and they haven't quite completely gotten there yet. And that just, I don't know, to me, the vision of them being on the bed with, you know, their backs sort of to us, but sort of slightly turned to each other, therefore only sort of slightly turned toward the camera, just seemed like a perfectly, the blocking and the cinematography reflected the emotion of that scene so well that it was just breathtaking for me.
And at the end of that scene, when he's in bed alone and it looks out toward the door to his room, you see the discarded, the hooks that are lying there that she's left, which is just such a nice little detail.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and even in the scene that we were talking about before in Butch's, where Dana Andrews eventually goes to the phone booth, initially you see the back of Al's head, and I'm sort of distracted by his head. I think maybe because his hair is cut really short in the back, and it's, you know, so you're seeing Dana Andrews' face, but you're seeing this sort of white neck of Al's. Mm. I think the shot is good because, and we eventually, we're going to see both of them, and they do two shots, and they do close-ups of the individuals. But the default sort of position for that shot and where it starts is they're in a booth, and Dana Andrews is facing us, and we see Al's back.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
and but Al's talking a lot of this time. They're not doing that thing where they feel like they have to flick between the two actors. Mm-hmm. Which is super interesting. Well, friends, what else do we want to say about the best years of our lives? We are still shorter than the movie itself, just to let you know.
I was hoping to meet you at the perfume counter
where all of us will meet eventually.
There are some really delightful, humorous moments. And one of them was at the perfume counter where the woman says, oh, I want a perfume, blah, blah, blah. And he says, oh, well, this one's a little expensive. It's like 16 something, but it's a nice size. And then he takes the lid off and it's a small little box. And then like he opens the top of the lid and then there's this little thing in there. And then he takes the little thing out and he's like, see? what a skillful moment.
1650 in 1946.
Right? Yeah.
That's a chunk of change right there.
So it makes you think, you know, later on when he punches that guy out for being truly, truly despicable, that's a lot of money's worth of damage that happened. It's not just the counter. It's the really expensive merchandise that's inside it.
Oh, and also I wanted to, I was reading up on Teresa Wright, and she was a real badass. She really fought against her studio and just really stood up for herself in her career. And I just made me want to, I love her so much in Shadow of a Doubt. And I guess there's a biography that came out a few years ago by an author who knew her quite well. So ooh. Now I want to immerse myself in Teresa Wrightness.
I would do that if only because she was in so many things with so many other interesting people, and not that she isn't interesting herself, but by all means she is. But sometimes that's for me a fascinating thing about a biography, is like how they're that glancing in her. Okay, she knew Hitchcock, she knew Joseph Cotten, she knew all these other, you know, worked with all these other people, and from her perspective, what were those relationships like? So mm-hmm. that's an argument for me to find that biography too.
Also, for speaking of Teresa Wright, you know, she wasn't sexy. I mean, she wasn't Joan Crawford, she wasn't Rita Hayworth, she wasn't Betty Davis or Katharine Hepburn either. She kind of had her own niche, the niceness yeah. niche, or however you want to describe
girl
her.
Girl next door.
But not bland and not vanilla. Very skilled actress. And she played very well with major stars of the day. If you think about Mrs. Miniver and the British firepower that's in Mrs. Miniver, and she, that's what she got her Academy Award for. So I think at some point there'll be a Teresa Wright, not revival.
Renaissance.
Maybe, yeah, Renaissance, her reappreciation.
A Teresa Wrightissance.
Wrightissance, the same thing.
Rightissance, exactly.
There we go.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like, you know, when people talk about the great stars of Hollywood, she's never mentioned, and yet she was in terrific movies, won an Academy Award for, and not for being bland or anything ordinary, just like a cut above ordinary.
Well, and I mean, I think her skill as an actor is why that character works so well in Shadow of a Doubt, because it's obviously it's written as a sympathetic character, but it kind of goes above and beyond. She's working with Joseph Cotten at that time, who's no slouch. And yeah, I think she does so well playing against other strong actors.
Yeah. And I think I love all of the things that you just said, Mickey, because it made me sort of reassess what she's doing. And I feel like in some ways she has a higher difficulty level for the parts that she is playing, because you're right, playing a character that is a good person and who is nice and who is kind without making it bland, without making it schmaltzy or over the top. Like that's a lot harder than it is maybe to be really intense or really funny or really melodramatic. It's, you know, kind of like people who are like, oh yes, so the Oscars always go to dramas, but it's actually harder to make a really good comedy. Same sort of thing. Like, yeah, the at least she did get an Oscar for Mrs. Miniver, but quite often that type of the role that she's playing here doesn't get the limelight in the way that it probably should, because it's because she does it so well that it just seems so natural. She's not doing a PTSD scene. She's not doing a, you know, weeping because her husband just got home sort of scene. She's not wearing flashy clothes and complaining that she can't go out to the nightclub. It's a much more straight ahead thing, and she just does it with aplomb.
So now I'm even more intrigued by her. I just looked at her IMDb, and in the 80s and 90s, she was in Murder, She Wrote, like every actress of a certain age. And she was in a Perry Mason movie. But here's the thing that surprises me. She played an uncredited character in The Exorcist 3.
Oh, my.
So I need to go download that. It says she plays a penitent. So
all right, please report back. I need to know. I don't really want to go watch The Exorcist 3, but I'm very curious. So
I will do it. I'll make the personal sacrifice for you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
I will give you one fun Teresa Wright performance. There's a movie called The Actress from 1953. It was based on Ruth Gordon's biography. And Ruth Gordon, it's the story of how she sort of became an actor, and she turned this into a movie. Spencer Tracy plays her father, and Teresa Wright plays her mother. So a little mismatch in terms of age there, but what else is new? It was the 50s. Mm-hmm. And Gene Simmons plays the Ruth Gordon character. But I love the script for that movie. Ruth Gordon, of course, great writer. She wrote, you know, Adam's Rib and Pat and Mike and things like that with Garson Kanin. So it's a funny picture. It's also touching. And the only objection I have, I guess, is the age difference. But I think she and Tracy work well together, because he's adorable in it. I just love that movie. It's kind of an underrated gem as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, The Actress from 1953. Friends, thank you so much for talking with me about the best years of our lives. I want to thank Mickey Maynard and Erica Ensign and Randy Dottinga for joining me. If you'd like to keep up with this here little podcast, you can go to theincomparable.com/LTS, where you can subscribe via any podcast platform you like and see show notes for all our past episodes. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra, or follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. Finally, if you'd like to drop us a line in email, you can do that at lts@theincomparable.com. 2 weeks from now, we have another great movie for you. And this is a kind of a tribute to an actress who died very recently, Marsha Hunt, who was in a number of very good film noirs, as well as having a long career in television when that came around, starting in the 50s and 60s. She also was quite an activist. And I'm sure we'll talk about all of these things in 2 weeks when we talk about one of her movies, Raw Deal, which also stars Claire Trevor, another favorite of mine, in a little bit of a love triangle with Dennis O'Keefe, which happens to be a noir. How much more could you ask for? We'll talk about Raw Deal in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for that, as well as other fun plans we have for you on Lions, Towers, and Shields. Bye now.